we all walk through the door of software to participate. It's not a software developer question. It's not a business manager question. It is an every human being question. So if you're a marketer, if you are someone with an MBA, if you are someone who likes to write technical docs, whoever you are, you have skin in this game. Because this is what stands between us living in societies that are equitable and open and societies that are not.
Welcome to Hello 5050 World, the podcast where we break tech bubbles before they break us and where we talk to people who make tech more humane. Today's conversation on the Hello 5050 World podcast is with Aaron Sago. Aaron is a passionate software developer with 25 and more years of experience in the tech industry. He has experienced the industry from several different perspectives. He founded his own companies, worked at Fortune 500 companies, including Nokia, worked with nonprofits, and was involved extensively with the open source community since the early days. Aaron and I, we worked together at a mapping technology company today. And one of the first questions I asked him even before he joined our team was whether working for a company producing mostly closed software is creating some inner friction for him. Today, we talk about open source development and contributor ecosystems, how they have evolved over the last two decades, and why they're being transformed right now. Let's dive in. Welcome, Aaron, to the Hello 5050 World podcast.
Good morning, Lisa.
So you've been part of the open source community for over 25 years. You've actually shared with me that your first open source contribution was in 1998.
Yes.
So how did you get started? What first drew you into contributing to open source software?
I was in a bookstore. I was picking up a book, actually, about system administration for Solaris that had just come out about a year before. And there was this book on the shelf that caught my eye, and it said Slackware. Which I thought was hilarious. What is this? Yeah, Slackware, is that like software for slackers, right? This is the, you know, mid-90s-ish. I had no idea what it was. So I picked it up as I'm waiting for them to go get my book from the back that I had ordered in. I'm leafing through it as I'm waiting. And at the back, I could feel there was something at the back. And I opened it to the back and there's a CD-ROM. And the CD-ROM said that it was a full operating system on it. And I flipped over the book to see how much it cost. And if I remember correctly, it was like $30 or something. And that was ridiculous because the cheapest, least expensive per seat license I knew at the time for a Unix-like operating system was literally $1,000 US. Most of them also required really expensive proprietary hardware. It was like, this cannot be true. So I bought the book, I took it home, and there it was. There was a very early version of Linux put together primarily by one person, this distribution on the CD-ROM, a person I would meet many years later, actually, in the open source community. And I was blown away by this. And what was even crazier was that all of the source code, all the engineering behind it was there. So not only was I getting something of immense value in my mind, right? This is at least $1,000 worth of stuff. And it came with just all kinds of things, servers for mail and web. And I mean, this is all expensive stuff. So that was an eye-opener. I started diving into it, using it, getting more familiar with it. And indeed, I made my first actual contribution to a text editor in 1998. And that was an exciting moment. You know, it's like, oh, cool, I'm, you know, giving something back. But what kept me there and what kind of put its claws in me in a very good way was that there was a philosophy behind it, all right? And this philosophy requires us to kind of accept two facts. One is that societies, that we build human societies around tools and shared goods. And the level of fairness and equity and equality that's possible in a society is directly related to how much access to participation people have in the workings of that society. If you can't participate in society, there's very real limits on your ability to be, get a fair treatment, be a part of, an equitable part of your own society. And we know that from history, right? The second fact is that our modern societies are foundationally resting upon software. whether it's healthcare, whether it's government services, whether it's work, whether, I mean, you can look at it from, you know, some of the oldest professions in the world, like farming, right? They're all reliant these days on software. This is not a bad thing. It's a great thing because it's an amazing set of tools. It allows us to do things that we just can't do anywhere else. I mean, the human discovery that we could take machines that don't have any moving parts and make them calculate and figure out anything just by changing, you know, the levels of electricity in them it has obviously been revolutionary. So that's fact number two. And if you put those two facts together, it quickly becomes apparent that if people do not have fair, equitable, open access to software, then you're not going to have fair, equitable access to society, not our modern societies, because those two things are just linked now. And an example that I often use to kind of illustrate this, because people, when they first think about this, sometimes they're like, how big is that of a thing? So in 2005, Hurricane Katrina slammed into the coastline of the United States. It devastated Louisiana, hit Texas hard, other states as well, but those two really took the brunt of it. Thankfully, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, had just released the year before their brand new website so they could digitize access to emergency services. So they didn't have to send out tens of thousands of people into hard-to-reach places. People in those hard-to-reach places, especially in a disaster, could reach out electronically and say, okay, I need help. I'm going to, you know, apply for aid. And it could all be done over computers. Beautiful, right? One problem. They focused on the dominant web browser at the time, which was Internet Explorer. And the people who developed it kind of developed it with an eye to the future. I put that in big quotation marks. So they had, it turns out unintentionally, put a few features in there that relied on one of the newer versions of Internet Explorer. You couldn't be using a very old version of it. Now, the people in some of these places that were hardest hit were not the most, they weren't in the top 1% of the economic ladder, let's say, right? These are people that if they had a computer, it was probably not new. It was probably running older software. They may not be the most, you know, computer literate people, but they basically had a computer and they could get online and, you know, do stuff. For a huge percentage of those people, this new website did not work simply because instead of using open protocols, open software, FEMA had bet on a proprietary technology to deliver socially critical, culturally community critical services. I mean, there's very few things that are more critical than delivering aid in a disaster. And they decided, yeah, it's fine if we're using a little bit of proprietary stuff here. And what it did, it just locked out huge numbers of people unintentionally. There's no malice or anything like that. And it really caused additional problems. What should have been a win became yet another problem in what was to become a very vexing response to a disaster there. So if you think about that and you kind of just transpose that to other parts of society, how do we deal with healthcare? How do we deal with access to government? How do we deal with access to education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? If we say that there are barriers to entry, you know, I can say whether you can or cannot use the software and how you can and cannot use it. If it's up to me whether it's in your language, if it's up to me to make sure as the person making the software, to make sure that it's culturally understandable and relevant to you and your community, you're now beholden to me as a gatekeeper to participation in society. And that realization, that was not my realization. That was something that people in the broader, what they would refer to as the free software community, had been working for a few decades on really refining these concepts and building this philosophy up.
You mentioned the Internet Explorer, yeah. And I want to quickly stay on the browser topic because yep. You have also quite a history mm-hmm. with browser technology. Can you quickly share how you were involved in creating open browsers?
Yeah, so I spent a large number of years in a fantastic community that is actually reaching its 30th year now, the KDE community, which started with one university student wanting to make open source software accessible to the people in his life. And he realized that people needed, you know, UIs that they could point and click at, and the ones we had sucked. And he was like, we can do better. And so he is German, so he called it the cool desktop environment with a K, and thus KDE was born. We were building a user interface layer on top of open source operating systems like Linux, although not exclusively Linux. And we wanted to produce something that anyone, an office worker, a person at home, a student, et cetera, could use, not just computer scientists, right? And something that they would like to use even. Could we make it something that was that approachable and that nice? And so we needed all the tools, right? You need a file manager, you need, probably need Minesweeper, but you also need a browser, a web browser. And at the time, there were no open source web browsers that were graphical. So this is going to maybe come as a surprise to a lot of people who listen to this, but there was a time when you had to buy web browsers. They were proprietary, and you could actually trade money to get one, which seems insane, and it was. And then there was Internet Explorer on Windows. It came with Windows, but it was also proprietary. So all of our software was like 100% of it was free and open source software. And so I was like, okay, how do we render web pages? We can't do that. And we don't want to force people to use Netscape, for instance, which was very large and heavy and didn't integrate with anything very well at the time. And so Netscape was the browser that leads to Firefox today. So a bunch of intrepid people went like, how hard could it be? And started writing a browser engine, something that could render basic HTML and, okay, run this JavaScript thing. Okay, that's cool. We can do that too. And display it in a window. And this gained steam. And it became increasingly useful. And you could I use it for a number of years as my daily driver. That's how I got around the web. The library itself is called KHTML. The browser is called Conqueror. Lots of K's. And this was great. So Apple at the time was going through its resurrection. So they had brought Steve Jobs back in. And Steve Jobs is like, look, we need to gut the operating system, bring something new in. He actually went out and re-platformed the Mac OS on top of an open source operating system, right? It's open source saved Apple in that sense. They did not have the budget, the means, or the people to do this work. And so they brought it in. And that's exactly what open source is about, or part of it anyways. And they also needed a browser. And they also didn't have the people to do it still, right? And so they looked around and without telling us, which is fine. Again, this is part of the freedom of free software. They forked the repository of KHTML, ported it to Mac OS, or so what was to become Mac OS X, and built Safari. They then told us, along with the rest of the world on the same day, that they had done this, which caused a lot of friction in the open community because in the open source community, people are used to working in the open. Open is a big word for us there. Apple doesn't work that way. And it would be an ongoing multi-year source of friction and challenges. And there'd be people that spend a lot of time and effort building bridges and conduits between them them being Apple and the greater community. But this becomes Safari. And then eventually Google decides they want to do a browser. And by this point, HTML has evolved into WebKit, which is this multi-platform, really capable thing to render web pages and run JavaScript. And they take that and make Chrome out of it. Meanwhile, WebKit has been invading like all sorts of everything from like smart TVs to early smart fridges and things like this. So it was really like getting out there in the world, which was very, very cool for us. And today, I don't know if there's even a line of code left anymore after all this time and all these revisions. But if you trace back the ancestry of the dominant browsers of today that have the lion's share of it, you come back to this small open source community with a couple of people who are like, hey, we need to render web pages. Yeah. So the long and windy road to... Yeah, open browsers. And it's kind of ironic now that it's highly controlled by one company.
I think in general, we can say that a lot of even the proprietary software that is available today, it actually relies heavily on free and open software. And that is also sometimes super tricky because these libraries might not be well maintained or there's actually no people managing behind it anymore. And I also know that today you are still very much involved in the open source community, also as a package manager yourself. Can you share a little bit what you're actually doing today?
Yeah, various things. So my most recent hack, if you will, is yet another iCalendar library. So it's not always the most glamorous work, but it's enjoyable. I've been working on a set of calendar libraries, as well as building up a set of open source, very much in theme with what we do day to day, around GIS. So there are amazing options for storing mapping data and geoinformatics data, things such as there's a database called PostgreSQL that has just amazing extensions for this. There's an embedded database called SQLite that has an extension for this as well. They're both amazing, but using them is extraordinarily arcane. And so I've been working on some libraries to simplify that. So you can, in your application, put a single line of code and you start getting vector map tiles coming out of your database that you can just send across to the browser and render. So yeah, I'm working on those sorts of projects these days.
And you have so many years of experience as part of the open source community. How have you seen the whole movement, basically? Because it is based on a lot of philosophical concepts, so I would call this like a movement as well. How has that evolved over the years, like from the early days to today? And where do you also see some challenges?
That is a big question. So in the very, very early days, it was a political movement, right, against the proprietization of technology. People forget that software used to be all open because it was very tied to the hardware that it came with. And so nobody even thought of selling software. That was an innovation that came about mostly in the late 70s, especially to consumers. And the selling part of it led to the proprietization of software. And people that were using computers at the time were not used to that. And when it started happening, it felt wrong to them. And they started thinking about it and realized the political ramifications of this, and so started taking action. So in the beginning, it was very much a political movement. But it rapidly became one where people found value in it in various ways. I mean, the number of motivations people have, as many as there are people. Some people are there because they just like doing it. And they like doing it with a community. Other people are doing it as part of their research. Some people see it as a way to build their CV. Other people see it as a way to build large, complex, shared technologies that they can then use to do other things, make a business. I have friends that work in Asia, for instance, to bring emergency response, open source emergency response systems into places that are experiencing disasters. So people have like so many different reasons they do it. That in the last, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years, open source kind of won, again, I use that in quotation marks, in that the pendulum had swung in the 90s to where proprietary was the standard. Everything, I mean, if anything wasn't, it was like, what? That's weird. Those shareware people. And by the 2010s or so, it had swung back the other way. And now open was almost the standard. It's like, oh, we've released this library. That was no longer newsworthy. And an entire generation of developers, which is amazing, kind of, you know, grew up or entered the industry with that as the reality. You just go to, you know, GitHub, and there are 8 billion, you know, repositories you can just grab and use. And you can go to npm.js, you can go to, you know, the Python repositories or wherever, and you can just grab huge numbers of just all this technology. Boom, there you go. You're welcome. And it felt like something that was just there, like a library. Who knows where the library comes from, right? Who knows who writes all those books? Oof, I don't write books, but I do go to the library, right? And so for a lot of developers, that was the experience. And that has really, really, really shifted kind of the middle of where the open source user and developer community is. So even people who contribute to open source these days are often doing it kind of as a tangent to their work use of it. They've come to it through work or through, you know, through studies sometimes. And now they're contributing because of that exposure to it. So the number of people that I come across that, you know, in these communities now that are there for, say, political reasons is diminished to a very, very tiny number. The number of people who are there for reasons of just, hey, I just love doing it, they're still there, but it is a smaller number as well. So it's kind of de-diversified in that sense, which isn't on its own bad. But unfortunately, the majority of people who are enjoying and reaping the benefits of open source, which is fantastic, don't have a real connection to it. is just another commodity for them to use. Again, like going to the library and picking out a book. And that has had implications. You mentioned earlier, it's like, well, maybe the library isn't maintained. You know, maybe it has, you know, issues. And that makes me smile because it's a bit like saying, you know, nobody's done the dishes in the kitchen. It's like, well, yes, they don't do themselves, right? Somebody does the dishes. It's not the most enjoyable job at times, but maybe it is. Maybe you hang out and listen to a podcast. Maybe you hang out with friends and you do the dishes. And it can be at least palatable. But it doesn't magically happen, right? Open source is not the result of the fairy kingdom. It's people like you and me that are putting in a bit of time, a bit of effort, and making it better. The reason why libraries become unmaintained is because two things happen. One, people are not sufficiently aware that you can participate and how to participate. It's almost a permission problem, which is weird because it's a permissionless thing. But that's, you know, a lot of people don't know. It's like, oh, how can I, you know, can I? How does that work? And the other side of it is that because a lot of the people who are writing these libraries did not sufficiently come up in the community that started the whole open source movement, in which we relied on each other heavily. And everyone was very afraid of being the one who let each other down. And so if I was working on something or you were working on something, we would make sure that there was another person who could pick up when we weren't there. Because we're doing it on our spare time. I'm going to go on vacation. I lose interest. You go away. They get sick. It happens. And so there was always, like the Sith, there's always two, right? At least. And these days, that's really often not the case. A lot of people that are working on free software or open source libraries fail to think about this. And they're just happy making the thing that they're making. And they get their thing they need done. And other people contribute to it. And they're like, yay, this is really exciting. And, you know, woof. But then they don't think about what happens in 5 years. And so you have a group of people that in a sense, it's a cultural loss, right, between the open source community that existed in the 2000s and what exists now, where the knowledge of how to do succession management and making sure that the bus number is more than one, that did not translate into this new community or generation of developers. And it's not healthy.
I have an anecdote here from the nonprofit world, where also at Hello 5050 World, we're mostly volunteers. And what I always say is, like, we are building a very large pedal boat, and we have to have enough people on the boat so that we don't always have to all pedal at the same time, but it's okay to sometimes take a break or kind of enjoy the ride, and others are paddling, and then we can switch again. So this is, I think, a very similar experience that you're sharing in the open source community, that we have to build these spaces where more people can join and contribute.
Absolutely. That's a perfect analogy.
And I do want to give you back this question that you actually put in the room on how can people actually contribute, or this sort of getting over this hurdle of jumping in and making their first contribution. What would you recommend for someone interested in that?
So for your first contributions, I do recommend not trying to take over maybe an unmaintained library, especially a big one at the beginning. Find somewhere that there's already a healthy community around this activity, that people are, for instance, accepting merge requests or pull requests from, and kind of see health there. If that's your first time, it'll help a lot, because it'll make it go a lot smoother. If you see a thing, try it. And if your patch makes it better, contribute it. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be hugely important. You don't have to reinvent the world, or just something small, right? And it doesn't always have to be code. Documentation needs to be written. Bugs need to be triaged. All the usual stuff, right? It's not. It's still software development. All the things that we do that aren't only writing lines of code and testing and whatnot, all that needs to be done. And it can be something really small. My own first contribution to KDE was the last thing I did before going to bed one night. I saw a bug. I was trying out their brand new, very crashy version of their thing. The desktop was pre-2.0. It was very crashy. It was called Crash, actually. It was very funny. And I found a small little bug, and it was annoying me because it was in the run dialog, and I couldn't run things properly all the time. So I looked at it, and I was like, oh, I see where the bug is. I fixed it, and I emailed it. At the time, we emailed patches between people. It was the Stone Ages. So I emailed the patch off, went to bed, and the next morning, it was merged, and I got an email back from the person who was like, oh, thank you very much. It's been, yeah, that's correct, yeah. And that blew my mind, right? I was like, cool. This is so nice and very addictive. So you can just be a very small thing, you know, a couple of lines. Just get used to the practice, or start the practice of what it's like to contribute back and be patient, right? The people on the other side, it's not like being in an office environment where, you know, you put a PR in and you can be rightfully annoyed if the person doesn't look at it for a week. You don't know where that other person is. They might have a lot of other things on their plate. They might not even be there right now. Be patient. And it's okay if things take a couple of days. And it's okay if they come back with comments and questions. They don't know who you are, maybe, right? So here comes this random contribution from a random person, and they're probably also getting to know you. So the first contribution often takes a little bit of back and forth. And some people are gentler and more helpful than others, and some people are a little more rough, and this is normal human behavior. But be patient with yourself and with them. And once you kind of learn or experience, not even learning, just experiencing the flow of it, it becomes easier and easier and easier. And then at some point, yeah, go grab that library that you're like, that should be better maintained, and maintain it better. And if necessary, you know, fork it and make your own thing out of it. That's one of the beautiful freedoms of open source, is that you can take it and you're required to work with those people on that code. You can take it and make your own thing with it. Give yourself permission to do that. That's 99% of it is permission and patience.
I'd love to hear from our listeners if they tried that. So let us know in the comments if you made your first contribution after listening to this podcast. I want to come back to this sort of tension or friction, as you called it, around closed software and open software. And maybe then also touching on some newer developments, recent technological changes around automation, artificial intelligence, and how this has impacted the open source community. Can you share a bit about your own experience of how this currently looks like in the contributor ecosystem?
What I have seen is a number of especially larger projects, one in particular, has at the moment basically turned off their external contributions because they were just being firehosed by what can best be described as, well, I guess the word is slop, right, these days. And it was taking too much time for them to review this incoming fire hose of garbage. There might have been some good things in there, but it was of such volume and of such low average quality, they just said, we're going to spend our whole lives doing this, let's not. That is highly damaging. The other thing that's really concerning that started to happen is some people have begun, some companies, in fact, have begun to take large language models and ask them to rewrite open source projects so that they can use them under different licenses. To call that legally dubious is to be generous. These are models that were trained on this exact, you know, body of software and code, and now you're asking it to regurgitate it, but change it a little bit. That's not how reverse engineering works. That's not how development works, and it really is just taking advantage of other people's work and effort and fractures, which is the exact opposite of what you want in a collaborative endeavor like open source. It fractures the community into several constituent parts. And what gets left over is, again, this quality of code that's not the best that now people are going to be using in production. This happened at Cloudflare. They did this with one product, done with a couple now. People immediately put into production, and there were several major security flaws found. The rate of pace that people are trying to go with it is uncalled for. It just isn't justified by the quality of the technology. That's not exclusive to open source, but it is being used. These technologies are being used in the context of open source to try and work around some of the legal and social contracts around them. That's unfortunate. There were people with very kind of high hopes that it would help relieve the burden of maintenance because we just have machines maintaining things. We're not there yet. It remains to be seen whether we'll get there yet. And what it has done more than that is drown people in too much content. So I think, you know, we need to find ways to moderate that and figure out how to work with that.
I guess the most famous example in this is Wikipedia. Right, which is also, it's not necessarily just open software, but also open knowledge. And these large language models, they've been hugely trained on all the knowledge that people have shared for free. Their infrastructure is completely overwhelmed with all the requests, and they don't really know how to cope. So these communities, I'm also seeing more and more, they're reaching out to the larger society with these issues. How do you think they will cope? Or like, what are you seeing, like how people organize themselves? What is maybe a way forward to also support and help them?
Well, I mean, from the you and me perspective, just continue contributing as regular, normal human beings. for groups like Wikimedia, like OpenStreetMap, these large bodies of information, right? And software is just another body of information, if you want to look at it that way. You know, you can support them financially as well. They often have ways to contribute monetarily, if you can't, with time and whatnot. And that's very helpful, because a lot of the responses to these issues require resources to be spent, compute resources often, as well as manpower to actually like figure out what are the solutions and implement them. So that can really help. And as individuals, we can also, you know, we can raise our voices, we can have our say, and we can make our choices, one, you know, kind of vote with our feet as well. It's a big topic. And I think we're years from knowing exactly how it will sort out. If anything I've learned, though, is that when really big hype machines roll into town, one of the best things you can do is not lose your head. Keep your homestead going. Stay doing what you're doing, and don't let it rock you too much.
I think the moral dilemma that you also touched on a little bit is that the open source community really relies on people giving back, right? And they also wanting to do that out of an intrinsic motivation. And it feels like at the moment with some of these developments that we're seeing, there's a lot of people taking advantage or making use of what's available for free. But if nobody is giving back, at some point this system will not work anymore, right? So how do you see that, or how does the community also deal with that?
So the core of the community will never go away unless it's forced to go away, right? There have been legal threats in various places of the world to make that happen. None of them have been successful, thankfully. That core community will never go away. In some sense, open source is an immune response to the denial of access to society through technology. And that immune response is not gonna just disappear. It will always be there for as long as that threat exists. The question is, can we keep it at the level, because we've achieved an immense level of open source in terms of reach, quality, breadth, footprint. The question is, can we keep it at that level, or will it atrophy, right? Interestingly enough, one of the ways that open source got to where it is now is not by that at all, but by essentially tricking companies into starting to use it and invest in. They're like, holy, you know, we get so much value out of this. IBM could drop literal billions per year departments working on operating systems and replace it with open source operating systems. They're like, yes, we will do that. We will happily do that. But that tied them into the ecosystem. Now they were betting their company on this ecosystem being vibrant and sustainable. And so they put billions of dollars into Linux. Right, and they still do, and they continue to do, and that's just one company. That wasn't a goodness of the heart of the people at IBM. That wasn't even an intrinsic thing. They're like, you know what we should do? It was a decision that they made, business decision, that then they're like, how do we now protect that business decision, right? And that was also not an accident. So there were people that were actively talking to the people at every level in IBM, all the way up to the CXO offices, talking to them regularly and walking them through this process, telling them, hey, here are the opportunities and here's how you maintain it, right? Those people who did that work over decades are great heroes, to me anyways. There was a time you'd have to tell people, so this is what open source means. And this is what free software is. You don't have to do that anymore. But what's still needed and is now missing, in my opinion anyways, is that outreach and those people who can sit down with you across from the boardroom table and go, look, here's the business opportunity.
So what you're basically saying is that the open source community doesn't only need developers, but also people with different skills like sales, marketing, outreach, the sort of evangelism, and that's missing a bit at the moment.
Business acumen, et cetera. Yeah, I mean, there was a time when in the community, there was a group of people that went off and got MBAs just so they could understand how to talk to people, you know, in suits. And it was extremely effective. It's what tipped it over the hump, really, in the 2000s were those efforts. So yeah, that's missing. And those are, yeah, not developer skills, right? This is a cultural social movement. I think people need to remember that this is a gateway to our society, right? We all walk through the door of software to participate. It's not a software developer question. It's not a business manager question. It is an every human being question. So if you're a marketer, if you are someone with an MBA, if you are someone who likes to write technical docs, whoever you are, you have skin in this game. Because this is what stands between us living in societies that are equitable and open and societies that are not.
When now going to dive into the rapid fire questions to wrap it all up. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right. The first one is, if you could rewrite one line of code or maybe a few lines of code in any product, what would you do?
If I could, I would go back in time and do two things. One, make Netscape open source so that we would start with open source browsers. The web was held together by open source servers. The web could have been much better with open source browsers. Second thing I would have changed is get rid of JavaScript and let them put TCL in instead.
To the next one, what's an everyday act of allyship that anyone can do, maybe also related to open source?
Share your light. It's a thing that costs you nothing and means a lot to the people that you do that for. Take a moment one-on-one, just let someone know something you've noticed that they've done that you think that has impressed you or that you think is of value. A lot of people are not able to see that in themselves. It's really easy not to, super easy not to. And it's one of the things that injects more energy, more positivity, and more robustness into people than almost anything else I know. And everyone can do it. Just keep your eyes open and let someone know when they've done something that you're like, wow, that was cool.
Awesome. And the next one is about the voices in tech. Do you think we should hear more from?
Yeah, people outside of the usual tech industry. One of the most impactful moments I ever experienced was learning that farmers in South Africa were using software that I had written along with other people in their own language, and they were able to use it to start running their farms for the first time because in their and they translated themselves. They had people translate it into their own language. They didn't ask for permission. They just did it. There are billions of people who do not have a voice in what we're doing, and each and every one of them are as beholden to the same software that we are. We need to be listening to these people. They have voices, they have minds, they have needs, and they have priorities, and we do not listen to them.
We'll wrap it up with the last one. If listeners remember just one thing from this whole episode, what should it be?
I'd like people to really think about the real connection between computing technology in particular, and free societies. It's easy to, again, not think about, but it's absolutely critical. If you want a free society, if you want to be a free person, if you want people to have equity and fairness, that requires fair, free, and open access to the technologies that drive our societies.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aaron, for being on the podcast and for sharing everything you know and have learned along the way.
It was great being here. Thanks.
Super awesome to be talking with Aaron about open source and going down the memory lane, learning about the history of open source development. What stuck with me is that the open source development is actually super important for software development as a whole, but also for society, because software today is everywhere and everybody's using it all the time. And making it accessible for both the usage, but also for people to contribute and participate is essential for a healthy society. I was also amazed that people that are contributing to open source software, they do this for various reasons, from the political or ethical motivations all the way to using it for work. And that actually the involvement of bigger organizations and corporations has helped to scale both the impact and the quality of open source throughout the last two decades. I also love that everyone can contribute to open source, not just developers. So whatever your skill set, if you're excited about this, jump in and find a way to give back. Thank you all so much for listening in. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know how you experience the open source community. If you contribute yourself, share it in the comments or on the Podigy website of this podcast episode. If you think there's someone that should be listening to this episode, please forward and also subscribe or rate our podcast. This really helps us to reach more people. And with that, see you next time.